Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome to New Books in Latin American Studies, a channel on the New Books Network. I'm your host, Elena McGrath. I'm here today with Megan Ryburn to talk about her book, Uncertain Citizenship, Everyday Practices of Bolivian Migrants in Chile. Dr. Ryburn is a British Academy postdoctoral fellow in the London School of Economics, Latin American and Caribbean Center. Her book received an honorable mention for the best book of social sciences in 2019 from the LASA Southern Cone Studies section. She is the book review editor of the Journal of Latin American Studies. Welcome, Megan, to the podcast.
Thank you so much. It's such a pleasure to be invited to talk to you. I really appreciate it.
Well, let's start off. The New Books Network likes to start by asking our authors to give us a little bit of how you got into this topic and even about your intellectual formation as a scholar. So what made you want to write a book about Bolivian migrants in Chile?
Well, I guess the answer to that actually goes quite a way back to when I was in high school. I'm originally from New Zealand, although I haven't lived there in a long time. And my interest in Chile and Latin America was sparked by a high school exchange to Santiago, which might not sound like an obvious place to go, but really, if you go east from Auckland, Chile is pretty much our nearest neighbor. It's about a 14-hour flight across the Pacific. And so this began my kind of what has really become, I think, a lifelong interest with the continent. And then this is coupled with a longstanding interest in forced and voluntary migration, which I developed particularly during my undergraduate degree, also in New Zealand. So my honours dissertation was based on oral history interviews that I conducted with some of the Chileans who came to my hometown of Christchurch as exiles from the Pinochet dictatorship. And sort of like then leading on from this, it was quite a natural step to then go and live in Chile in Santiago for a couple of years after my undergraduate degree. I taught English and I volunteered with a refugee and migrant NGO there. And then I went to study my master's and PhD in the UK. And the book is based on the doctorate that I carried out there, which I undertook under the brilliant supervision of Professor Kathy McElwain, who's a migration studies expert, and Professor James Dunkley, who's one of the foremost historians of Bolivia. And with them, we formulated this project about Bolivian migration to Chile. So that's really how it all came about.
That's great. So let's talk a little bit about the history of Bolivians, particularly in Chile, and how they come to cross the border in so many numbers and what draws them to Chile.
Okay. So I guess maybe to start off, just a little bit of background about something of the history of Bolivian migration, perhaps a little more generally, and then more specifically to Chile. So I think these estimates are a couple of years old now, but it's estimated that between 7 and 23% of the Bolivian population reside outside the country. And why there's such a big margin there is that statistics on migration are sort of notoriously hard to get accurate statistics. There's often no comprehensive database for recording exits and entrances, and some people may enter or remain in destination countries without documentation. But basically, we can conclude that there's quite a high percentage of the Bolivian population living outside the country. And this migration to other countries really began particularly in the 1970s, which was, as you'll know better than me, I'm sure, a decade of real political upheaval. And then this was followed in the 1980s by the implementation of neoliberal economic policies under President Paz Estenssoro. And basically, there was this political upheaval, and then the long-term impact of these economic measures was increased social injustice, a lack of economic growth, and things like unemployment rising to around 20%, and working conditions becoming increasingly precarious. And this started to drive migration to other predominantly neighboring countries in this moment. And just to backtrack there a little bit, there had before this and sort of continuing in this period also been a real increase in rural to urban migration within Bolivia, which has continued to this day. But then in terms of this migration to other neighboring countries, in the 70s and 80s, the kind of preferred destination really is Argentina and particularly Buenos Aires. And it's worth highlighting that quite a lot of this migration was predominantly women migrating. A lot of women would go to work in Buenos Aires in small sweatshops that were producing garments. And the labouring conditions were really pretty appalling, very limited protection for their labour rights. And often women would really be in a situation of sort of debt bondage. So this was one type of migration that was happening quite a lot in this period and has indeed actually continued to the present day. And there's still a lot of Bolivians in Buenos Aires, in Argentina more broadly. But following the 2001 crisis in Argentina and the devaluation of the Argentine peso, a lot of people who previously might have looked to Argentina as a destination also started to look elsewhere. And for those who had the resources to do so, moving outside of the continent became an increasingly popular option, particularly to Spain and to the United States. But there were still many Bolivians on lower incomes than this who could not afford to leave the continent, but felt that it was necessary to leave the country in search of really a better life. And, you know, as Bolivia entered the 21st century, it remained one of the poorest countries in Latin America. So this was something that was really pushing migration. So in this period, following the devaluation of the Argentine peso and the crisis there, Brazil becomes a very popular destination, particularly Sao Paulo. And then this is where we also start to see this shift towards Chile. And this is kind of consonant really with more general shifts in migration to Chile since the 1990s. So with the return to democracy in Chile in 1989, 1990, we slowly start to see an increase in migration and then really kind of a boom in the last decade. So just to give you some sense of that in numerical terms, in 1992, there were an estimated sort of 115,000 migrants living in Chile, which is about just under 1% of the total population. Then when I was conducting a major part of the work in this book in around sort of 2015, the migrant population in Chile was about 465,000 or 2.7% of the population. And today, there are over 1.25 million migrants in the country, and that's around 7% of the total population. So it really has been exponential growth. And we're also
That's a really startling number.
It sure is, right? Yeah. It's pretty astonishing. And I guess the thing that has been consistent through this time is that around 90% of those migrants have been from other Latin American countries. But whilst it used to be mainly Argentina, Peru, Bolivia, now there's real increasing diversity. So we've got more people coming from Venezuela, which makes sense, right? Also from Colombia, and then also further afield as well, like Haiti and other places as well.
So your book then becomes really timely because, well, uncertain citizenship is concerned with the citizenship of migrants specifically. And you show how those migrants have lived experience of inclusion and exclusion that complicate formal binaries of citizen or non-citizen, and they move through their lives and across borders and end up with a number of overlapping changing statuses. Mm-hmm. So your exploration of this transnational, this overlapping, this fluctuating space of citizenship, what does this way of understanding offer scholars of both migration and citizenship in the Global South?
That's a big question and one which I'll try to answer. And I think the best way might be to answer that in a bit of a circuitous way by first trying to summarize a little some of the conceptual thinking in the book before I come back to try and respond better to your question. So drawing on this ethnographic fieldwork, I use it to develop these twin ideas of transnational spaces of citizenship and uncertain citizenship. And to do this, I draw on work on the anthropology and sociology of citizenship in Latin America, and also feminist scholarship on citizenship that comes from within political theory. And from both these bodies of work, citizenship is increasingly understood as both possession of a formal legal status and the ability to access substantive rights, like, say, the right to shelter or the right to healthcare. And also citizenship is understood as something that is constantly being constructed, right? And this is both through top-down processes and from below, through the everyday practices of ordinary people who may have uniform possession of formal citizenship status, but of course may often have differentiated access to these more substantive rights of citizenship. And this access is often contingent on social identities like gender, like race and class. And how this relates to migrant citizenship? Well, migrant citizenship has often been thought of in these quite binary terms. So migrants are either thought of as they're either a citizen or they're a non-citizen. And if not in these terms, then it's thought of maybe in what we could think of as a triadic formation. So migrants are citizens, they're non-citizens, or they're in this quite neat third space. And for me, in doing this fieldwork, what I found was I didn't feel like these approaches really conveyed this cross-border entanglement of fluctuating and multiple and simultaneous exclusions from some aspects of citizenship, but inclusion in others that many migrants live. And so I prefer instead to think about migrants' relationships to different but interconnected transnational spaces of citizenship. So the legal, economic, social, and political spaces. And I use this as a device to try and remind myself, to help my readers pay attention to each of these spaces, but also acknowledge that there's a lot of overlap. And I think about these spaces as constructed by interactions between individuals, but also with states, and then perhaps international organizations and groups within civil society. But sort of to put that in more simple, concrete terms, to give an example, say upon moving to Chile, I would suggest that a mestizo Bolivian man who has a university degree is likely to experience very different patterns of exclusion from those of, say, an indigenous Bolivian woman who hasn't finished secondary school. So to take this as a kind of hypothetical case, perhaps she's on the very periphery of legal citizenship in Chile. So maybe she holds a tourist visa, but she's working unauthorized, whilst, of course, she has full possession of legal citizenship in Bolivia, where she's not currently residing. And then if we look at the political, say she's exercising her right to extraterritorial voting, perhaps, and as part of a dance fraternity in Chile, which is something I see as a potentially political act, but she cannot vote in Chile. With respect to the social, she perhaps had better access to healthcare in Bolivia than in Chile. And with regards to the economic, she's left Bolivia because she couldn't find waged employment there, but she's very precariously employed in agriculture in northern Chile. And these complex aspects of her citizenship across borders could shift and change. And this depends both on her exercise of agency through maybe a practice like applying for legal residency, perhaps with support from a migrant organization, but also on more structural factors like a change to immigration law. And a change in one of these dimensions of her citizenship might impact another dimension, but it equally might not. And this very complex array of shifting inclusions and exclusions, for me, I felt like it was best captured through a lens of uncertainty, which is an optic I've realized has been used quite a lot in other ethnographic research in topics in the Global South. And for me, uncertainty goes some way to trying to capture this exclusion and inclusion and this state of flux. So after saying all of that, and to return to your question, what I really hope that this approach does is to encourage us to think about citizenship and not just migrant citizenship, citizenship more broadly, as a fluid and lived experience across multiple dimensions, which is very profoundly impacted by social identities and becomes even further complicated when people move across borders.
I think that framework offers a lot of utility for understanding the way that migration is experienced, both in the Global South, but not only, because I can see the application of these ideas in contexts such as the United Kingdom or the United States as well. And so I think it's very helpful. So let's talk a little bit about your methodology here, mm-hmm. because you are doing a multi-sided ethnography, and you are trying to participate within and build trust with a series of vulnerable populations that tend to be, you know, many scholars have seen this, right, fairly wary of being too findable, too identifiable or engaging with institutions at all. So how did you approach this in your research? How did you try to build trust while keeping your informants safe and think about your own positionality in these communities?
Mm-hmm. Well, first of all, I'd say I just think that's such a good and important question, and something I try to keep very present, and which I think we really can't give too much attention to as researchers. And I guess there are kind of various points to my answer to this. So first of all, I think an ethnographic as opposed to perhaps other qualitative methods approach has been really fundamental for me in this research, in terms of allowing me to try to slowly build relationships of trust. So to give time and space for potential participants to get to know me, and to really try and make sure that I'm engaging in a sort of a process of proper informed consent. The emphasis there really on the informed part, to be part of the project so people really understand what it's about. And also, and in conjunction to that, it's always been important for me to work in collaboration with organizations that are advocating for migrants' rights and are able to offer support services to the participants in my research, so that I could, be also a liaison point for a vulnerable population and to, say, put them in touch with services that could offer legal advice or sort of social work and psychological support services if those were necessary. So that's really important to me as well. And then I guess the other part of my response here would be to say, yeah, it's hugely important to try and maintain a critical stance regarding one's own positionality. And this is always imperfect, and it means constantly trying to remind oneself to recognize, in my case, my privilege as a straight, white, middle-class woman from the Global North, and what this means in the different contexts of my research. Because whilst, yes, of course, a lot of it has been carried out directly with migrants who may be experiencing different kinds of vulnerabilities, I also, have conducted research in places like consulates. And so I do work across different spaces as well. And my identity, of course, means different things in different places. And I guess a big part for me of thinking about positionality is trying to talk and write about this as openly as possible, even though, and especially because this is sometimes really uncomfortable. And I try in the introduction to my book to give a few examples of this. And I think the one for me that I always really come back to is thinking about my relationship with the migrant participants in my work. So these relationships were generally colored by real kindness, openness, and trust. I was really received very warmly. Once we'd kind of addressed these concerns, these very valid concerns around confidentiality and anonymity. And there'd be a lot of laughing and joking, and I would also share experiences of my life, right? And I would see a shift in relationship as we kind of moved from a more formal, reserved relationship where we might be using usted to using tú and things like this. But there were these moments that I think were very important reminders to me of the vast differences between our life situations. And one in particular was at the end of an exchange with a woman who I'll call Magdalena. She was working as a live-in maid. And we'd been having quite a serious conversation, and then it evolved into we were kidding around about relationships, juggling commitments, and laughing. And then suddenly she just touches my arm and she says, "Hey, I know, I could come and work as your maid and I could look after your children." And for me, it was just such a stark reminder of, you know, there was so much truth inherent of that, that observation about our vastly different circumstances. And I think it's, yeah, it's beholden to us as researchers to come back to this and to think about these things.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Particularly for researchers who are new to this kind of ethnographic approach, it would behoove them to read your exploration, because these issues are so present when you're dealing with any sort of community of people that's very different. But it's also true that the personal and the personal relationships can get very caught up in, and it almost overshadows what is still a difference in life experience that is substantial. And so, I think your book treats that well. Thank you for sharing that. So I want to talk a little bit about the structure of your book, because you start by offering the reader your sort of theoretical framework around citizenship and uncertainty. And then you talk about the different places and spaces of this kind of uncertain citizenship. And then the last several chapters are exploring different moments, different ways of getting at these different valences and these overlapping and fluctuating spaces. So let's start with your chapter on papeleo. And what you use this term, which is like paperwork bureaucracy, right? I love it, having done research in Bolivia before. So your research sees the importance of this official bureaucratic status, but instead of using it as like a cutoff point, you're not trying to overemphasize this divide. So you look at papeleo as a practice or as a process and an experience. Can you share some examples of how this works in your book?
Sure. I'll do my best. And I guess it's important to say as well, before I try and do that, that, you know, I really deplore this increasing move globally to criminalize migrants and migration, and to frame things in terms of illegality or bogus asylum seeking and so on and so forth. There's some really frightening discourses and practices of dehumanization of migrants and refugees. So you know, I do very much stand with migrant rights advocates and critical migration studies in saying that it's very fundamental that we think about migrant legality, in inverted commas, and the very substantial role that legal status plays in migrants' everyday lives. But as you say, and I think here, there can also be something of an overemphasis on the this aspect of migrant citizenship, which can sometimes come to the neglect of examining other aspects of citizenship. And there can also be something of an overemphasis too on a kind of either-or situation where a migrant is either considered as regular or irregular. And the reality, as you suggest, is actually often a lot more complicated than this. And what the legislation says on paper may not be what is enacted in practice. So I've been trying to think about how to explain, give you an example of this. And it's quite a complex topic to discuss because there are just so many intricacies to the legislation. So I'm going to try and give a bit of a simplified version of one example to show what I mean. So in simplified terms, in the time when I was doing this research, migration legislation, this is a bit of a footnote, but migration legislation is going through a bit of a period of change in Chile now. But at the time of my research, the way it looked on paper that a Bolivian would enter Chile and then start to work there would be that they would enter the country on what is called a tourist visa, which in the first instance would last for 90 days. During this period of being on the tourist visa, technically they couldn't really work. In this period, however, they could apply for something called the Mercosur temporary resident visa at a cost of $283 US. Bearing in mind that at this stage, the minimum monthly wage in Chile was $334 US. So that is a substantial amount of money. And they would need to apply for this while they had the tourist visa and were in Chile. It should be a straightforward process to do so. And after this, this would kind of lead to permanent residency, was the kind of linear way that this looks on paper. And as I discuss in the book, there are lots of ways in which this is undermined in practice. But to give just one example, in the north of Chile, in the Valle de Sapa, which is near Arica, that this is a fertile oasis in the desert where there's a lot of agricultural work and where predominantly Aymara Bolivian migrants work on agricultural small holdings. And these are settings of real isolation and deprivation, like people working in some pretty shocking conditions and living in some pretty shocking conditions in these places. And the isolation is really fundamental here, like an isolation from kind of Chilean society more broadly, and thereby being cut off from understanding how processes of regularization might work, for example. So what I found was that a lot of these agricultural workers were, instead of going through the process of getting a temporary resident visa and so on and so forth, they were entering and exiting multiple times on tourist visas. And this was very much encouraged by the patron, that's the word, the very colonial word that was used to refer to the owner of the smallholding. It, you know, this serves by keeping them on a tourist visa. They are not undocumented per se, but they are working unauthorized, and thereby it gives the patron quite a lot of power to exploit them, which is something that migrant workers who have been doing this for a long time sort of slowly came to realize, that this was a form of control and coercion, rather than, as the patron would often start by saying, oh, it's just easier, then you don't have to do all that papeleo, you don't have to pay that money. But as one migrant woman said to me, actually being kept on this tourist visa like this gave them, quote, the power to enslave you. You're afraid, you don't have the right to demand anything. Whilst there'd be this like seemingly straightforward linear process that they could have gone through to get a regular status, actually in practice, something quite different was going on, which is falls into this gray area of, yeah, it's not legality, it's not illegality, it's not somewhere in between.
Absolutely. So they're not like hiding across the border, but at the same time, this status is a perpetual guest status. Is absolutely one of vulnerability.
Absolutely.
So you've talked about this already a little bit, but I'd love to hear more about how you found gender, race, and class shaped Bolivian access to economic rights and economic citizenship in Chile. And you have a whole chapter on the experience of economic citizenship, which I thought was a very interesting way to look at it at a slightly different angle than the papaleo and the uncertainty that paperwork and legality create.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I tried to look at economic citizenship both in terms of what people have previously experienced in Bolivia, and it's, you know, it's often economic precarity which has compelled them to leave the country. But I also look at it in terms of what their economic citizenship might look like once they're in Chile, particularly in Chile in terms of access to decent work. So not just thinking about, you know, access to wages and so on and so forth, but also like the nature of the work that they're engaged in, and how precarious or not that might look. And as you suggest, absolutely, gender, race, and class hugely shape Bolivian access to economic citizenship. And in the book, I discuss how this plays out in a range of different employment niches, from agriculture, like I've just mentioned, to the wholesale retail of garments, and to domestic labor and cleaning. And I think the latter gives us a very obvious example of this. So there's some great work from scholars Carolina Stefoni and Rosario Fernandez, where they trace how domestic work in the capital of Santiago used to be predominantly carried out by internal migrant women from the south of Chile, who are often indigenous, often Mapuche or mestiza. And how over time, whilst there are still Chilean women carrying out these roles, but this employment niche has increasingly also been filled by migrant women from other Latin American countries. And this serves to reproduce a particular gendered, racialized social order. And this is work that entails very long hours, whilst it is nominally subject to labor legislation. It is often very unregulated because it happens in the private sphere of the home. So, for example, a lot of the women I worked with who did this kind of labor, they wouldn't have an employment contract, even though they should have. They would work excess hours. They would often be in quite subject to quite a lot of kind of psychological abuse. And they were very isolated. Again, isolation really comes up as a theme here. And that led to a real limiting of their ability to be sort of to engage in decent work, to have economic citizenship, but also to access their other dimensions of citizenship, right? And I talk about in an earlier chapter in the book about how, for me, this is really exemplified in the geography and the planning of upper middle class homes in Santiago. So even today, houses that are designed for the upper middle classes that are kind of maybe towards like the east of the city or towards the mountains are built with this bedroom and bathroom, which is called the dormitorio y baño de servicio. So it's designed for a live-in maid. And this room is next to the kitchen and next to the laundry. It's a tiny little pokey room. And I think this just symbolizes so clearly these kind of gendered and racialized hierarchies into which, you know, migrant labor increasingly falls.
So I'm particularly interested in, you have a chapter on solidarity or solidaridad, and I was struck by the way that Bolivians criticize Chileans not necessarily as much for discrimination as for a lack of solidarity. And this is such an interesting framework because scholars tend to write about migration assuming vast differences in culture and background between sending and receiving nations. And we can think of internal migration and external migration as something that is very different. But as you just mentioned, you have Chilean, sort of wealthy Chilean families being used to maybe a Mapuche indigenous woman coming to clean their house. And instead now it's a Bolivian, potentially indigenous woman, maybe mestizo woman, mm-hmm. filling the same category. And so on some level, Chileans, I think, see themselves as quite different than Bolivians. But Bolivian migrants don't necessarily understand this to be a vast difference. And so framing their treatment in terms of expecting solidarity allows for a different kind of understanding of the exclusions they experience and the way they want to be included. So can you talk a little bit about how you came to that idea and what that shows?
Absolutely. So actually, really interestingly, I think you've kind of set that up really nicely for me and explained that really well. And it was, in fact, a reviewer of my manuscript who pointed this out to me. So I had noted and written about throughout this chapter this call to solidarity that participants repeated. But I think I was too close to the material to see it as something that was different from how migration is often framed. So I'd kind of written about it in a very matter-of-fact way without realizing the potential significance of this. So when I revised the chapter, I tried to give it the salience it seemed to warrant. But as I say, it very much came from how participants talked about their difficulties accessing what I would term sort of different social rights in Chile. So they were talking about their experiences of trying to access shelter, education, healthcare, and the constant discrimination that they came up against. But the way of framing it, as you say, was, you know, in the words of a woman called Constanza, who had faced a lot of these kind of difficulties, was saying, I wish they would show us more solidarity. When I asked her the question, what would you most like to see improved for migrants in Chile? And this was a language that I saw repeated. So it was striking that the material consequences of living in poor housing, struggling to access good schooling and adequate health care were obviously mentioned. But it was this sense almost of betrayal, of indignation, and of a letting down of expectations that was really quite transversal to the way this was spoken about. And yeah, I guess this gives a particular character to the way that racism from Chileans was experienced by the Bolivians I worked with. So yes, words around discrimination and racism and so on and so forth would be mentioned. But yes, it would often be framed in terms of this, like, this lack of solidarity. And I think that this can encourage us as migration scholars to perhaps give more weight to the similarities between sending and receiving cultures and countries, to think more about, because I think a lot of migration research has been around, I think the terms south, north are rather sweeping and need to be complicated, but to put it in those terms, a lot of migration research has been around south-north migration, right? And perhaps when we think more about what can be termed as south-south migration, we might need to rethink some of these similarities and differences between sending and receiving cultures and countries, and the complexity of ways in which discrimination may be lived and experienced. And in this case, yes, it was very much framed in a language more of a lack of solidarity.
So then your final chapter before the conclusion is about dance troupes and carnival dances, particularly as political practices and practices of citizenship. And I really love this chapter, and I was hoping you could give the listeners a sense of what this carnival dance tradition looks like and how Bolivian migrants use dance as a political practice and how they use this to demand space in Chile and in the cultural imagination of Chileans.
Okay, thank you. I'm really glad you enjoyed the chapter. I think it was my favorite to write as well. And so I'd say, first of all, that quite a lot has been written in migration studies about migrants' political claims making, but not in a way that recognizes the potential political importance of dance or of other performance arts for migrants and ethnic minorities. Whereas by contrast, say in the discipline of anthropology, and not migration studies, within anthropology, we have quite a lot written about the potential political significance of something like carnaval. And in the Bolivian context, I'm thinking maybe of work by Daniel Goldstein, by Sean Lassar. And carnival really can be seen to represent a time when the normal order of things is subverted, and where through a claiming of space and a claiming of time, ordinary people make this claim to be seen, to belong, and to be citizens. And it was really a version of this that I saw happening in Chile. And whilst the ethnographic work I did specifically with a carnival dance group was in Santiago, this was something that you could also see in the north in Arica, for example. So to just say a little bit about what this might look like and what my participation involved. So I came to dance with, perhaps rather badly, but I did try my best, with a dance fraternity founded in 2010, called, in my book, I don't use its real name, I call it Corazón de Tincos. It was founded by a Bolivian living in Chile, who I'll call Anthony, and his Chilean partner called Marcia, also a pseudonym. And it had predominantly Bolivian members, but also Chileans, Peruvians, and me. And a little of the history of this dance fraternity is important for understanding what kind of claims making was taking place. So, to backtrack slightly, the dance that this group was doing in particular, they were doing lots of different kinds of carnival dances, but the one that they would mainly do in street performances in Santiago is called Tincos, which is one of a myriad of dances that comes from Bolivia, this one specifically from Potosí originally. And it is the danced iteration of the traditional Tincos fight. And yeah, I wish I had a better medium for being able to explain what that looks like. So maybe if you're interested, it might be worth having a look at a YouTube video or something like that to give you a sense of what this is like visually. But so it's one of the traditional carnival dances from Bolivia. And what had been happening in Chile, kind of through the I think particularly around the time of the student protest in 2011 in Chile, but a bit previous to that as well, is that Chilean groups had been using this dance, which, as I say, originates from this Tincos fight, so it kind of has these warrior-like connotations. And they had been using it in these political protests that were very much coming from the more radical left. And there was... so Anthony and others would claim, no recognition within these groups who were predominantly Chilean students that this was a dance that was not, as they called it, Andean, but rather was very much specifically Bolivian and came from Potosí and had a particular set of meanings within Bolivia. So Anthony and others were saying that this was a case of real cultural appropriation by these Chilean students and that they were making this dance into a tool for radical left politics when that was not what it was supposed to mean. And so they founded this fraternity, Corazón de Tincos, to try and combat this appropriation. And the focus of Corazón de Tincos was doing the dance properly, because Anthony said that the other groups weren't doing it well, they weren't doing it properly, and shouting loudly and clearly and very literally that the dance comes from Bolivia. So we would shout in the streets, we would say, ¿Quiénes somos? Tincos somos. Who are we? We are Tincos. ¿De dónde somos? De Bolivia. Where are we from? From Bolivia. And this would be a repeated chant that we would do while we were dancing. And it was fundamental for Anthony that the group members would really understand what it means to dance carnival in Bolivia and to really understand the rituals and traditions behind Tincos and other dances. So Chileans and people of all nationalities could be participants in the fraternity. They were extremely welcome, but there was a real desire to sever it from these radical left politics, even though ironically most of the group members were themselves kind of left-wing in their political persuasion. But for Anthony, that wasn't the point. It was that this was a form of cultural appropriation which he wanted to confront. And moreover, dancing this in the street not only was about this kind of reappropriation, it was also a way of trying to demonstrate a positive Bolivian identity in the face of a lot of discrimination and a positive Bolivian migrant identity. And dancing in public space was seen as a way of challenging discrimination, invisibilization, and hardship. And this was expressed not just by Anthony, but by many other members of the fraternity. But, and I think this is really interesting, this wasn't just there was a particular way of doing this dance. There was a particular way of expressing this identity, but it was one that could be learnt and expressed by Chileans, by Peruvians, by me. And the Bolivians expressing it, I think, were also showing this wish to belong to the Chilean body politic. So it was quite a complex, multi-layered expression of a desire for citizenship and for political belonging across borders. And I guess for me as well, you know, the specific example and what it specifically meant in this its context, but I think the broader point is that for me, this example really showed the relevance of field work. I would not have come to understand this without sustained ethnographic research. And as with the reflections on solidarity, I think it through this field work, it helped me to challenge some blanket assumptions about migrants' lived experience, about what politics might look like. So yes, it was one of the very, very interesting and rich parts of my research.
Fieldwork and participant observation particularly, yeah. And I like the distinction you draw here between, it's not that you couldn't do the dance or that Peruvians or Chileans couldn't do the dance, but that the dance has to be done in its Bolivian context and the participants have to, the Bolivians have to control the process, right, of the, mm-hmm. of the culture. And that's a good example of that. So then, what's next for you in your research? You have this book has come out and, you know, won awards from LASA, and it's a wonderful book. So where are you going in your research next?
Well, I guess there's kind of continuities and change in my research. So in terms of continuities, I'm still working on migration in Chile. I'm currently halfway through a 3-year project where I'm working with Colombian women migrants in Antofagasta in Chile, which is also a northern city, although not quite as far north as Arica. And between 2019 and the very start of this year, pre-COVID, I've completed 5 months fieldwork in Antofagasta, but also, again, I'm doing sort of multi-sited work in the Valle de Cauca in Colombia as well, which is where most of the women I work with are coming from. And this included in July of last year, I did an overland bus journey from Cali to Antofagasta, which was took 8 days, 87 hours on buses. It was quite an odyssey.
Hard.
It was. Although I feel like, you know, my experiences were nothing compared to those of the people I work with. So
absolutely.
Yeah. But it was a real eye opener. And more conceptually, the reason I've been doing this work is because I'm maintaining my previous interests in citizenship and migration, but I'm really trying to push further in terms of exploring structural violence and also in this context, physical violence and ideas around bordering. So that those are the kind of conceptual ideas I'm trying to develop further in this work. And I'm also in this project really hoping to look at alternative ways of producing research outputs that have more relevance to the people who I work with. So, you know, it's all very well to write this book in English, and I'm proud of it, and I'm very pleased that it was released. But one is left with the question of what does this mean for the people I work with? And I think for me, one of the things that I'm now trying to do is I'm becoming increasingly interested in ways of co-producing, always imperfectly, I think. But I'm currently trying to make a short animated video with a group of women and a video designer that will tell some of their stories in a way that we hope can reach a broader audience and also be more of a sort of a joint effort to produce this. So yes, that's where I am at the moment, in the middle of work. So it's all a bit messy, but I'm really, really enjoying it.
That's a really great project, and I look forward to seeing how it comes together. And especially that the short animated video, did that come from a suggestion from the people you were talking to, or how did you choose to focus on short and animated, or an animated video?
I guess it was a kind of a a range of things, really. I guess from conversations with people I've worked with over the years and thinking about this issue of the relevance of my research, how to communicate it and how to better co-produce it. So that was where the idea for perhaps a more visual medium came from and for a video. And then animated that. Well, there were various reasons for them. That one is because I have a very good long-standing friendship with a video animator. So I knew the kind of things that animation could be used to do, and because it provides a perfect vehicle really for doing something that's anonymized. And that's really important because I work with quite vulnerable populations, people who really want to share their stories, but in a way that is safe. And so by having an illustrated video, this provides us with a way of doing that.
That sounds like a perfect vehicle for that. Absolutely. Well, thank you so much for all of your answers and for talking to me about this book. I really encourage our listeners to go out and pick it up and read it. And thank you so much. I hope you have a great afternoon.
No, thank you. It's been wonderful talking to you, and I really appreciate the time that you've taken to read the book and really engage with me on it. Thank you.